You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Mompos, Bolivar. That's right. For those of you who have children at school in Colombia, you'll know that it's half term. Here on the coast, they call it the Semana de Uribe. But for those of us here, it is half term, and I'm enjoying a little break from Bogota and the rain thereabouts. Anyway, this week is episode 444 of the Columbia Calling podcast, and we have very special guest, Jenny Pierce. She's a research professor at the Latin America and Caribbean Center at the London School of Economics. Anyone who follows Latin America closely will know her name because she's been, well, reporting on the area and visiting the area since the 1960s. And this time with Juan David Velasco, a politologist, a political scientist from the Javeriana University in Bogota. They've written a report about the elites and violence since 1991 in Colombia. 1991, you'll remember, is the period where the new constitution was put into play. So she's going to be talking to us about the elites and the violence. And it's only really a little over 1,000 people who control most everything in Colombia. And so that's what's revealed, something that we already knew, but revealed in this podcast. And it's a fascinating look at the way, that Colombia works, the machinations behind the politics, beside the politics, up and down through the politics. So please stay tuned for this episode 444 after the news with Emily Hart. We'll be back with Jenny Pierce, research professor at London School of Economics. So don't go away. Thank you again.
And we're back. This is segment 3 of the Columbia Calling podcast. I've been talking about this upcoming podcast for some time because it's been a while in the works. And my very special guest is no less than Jenny Pierce, research professor of the Latin American and Caribbean Center at the London School of Economics, and basically one of the minds, the great minds about Latin America and, studying the elites and so on and so forth. So let me just say, welcome on the Columbia Calling podcast.
Thank you very much. Very pleased to be here.
No, it's a real pleasure. It's a real pleasure because I know your name from a long time, never spoken to you in person. It's over a month ago now that I was reading El Espectador, and there it was. It popped up the link to your latest report with the political scientist and teacher Juan Velasco of the Universidad Javeriana, so my alma mater. But it popped up, and it's about the power concentrated in Colombia by the elites. It's called Elites, Poder y Principios de Dominación en Colombia from 1991 to 2022. Let's just start because, I mean, we could ask you anything, but let's focus on this report. Let's just start. How did you decide to compile this? Because I can name some elites here and there, but this is a very in-depth investigation. So let's start. How long did it take?
Well, I've been working for about 5 years on elites in Latin America, and I've done a lot of work, particularly in Mexico and Colombia, and I've been doing a lot of interviews. But what I wanted to do was something that actually, first of all, defined the word much better. Mm. And there's a huge literature on what is an elite and a lot of controversy and differences of opinion, but also then to find a way of actually developing a quantitative measure as well as continuing to do qualitative research through interviews. Mm. And so working with Juan David Velasco and the team, we had a team of people to which I'm extremely grateful. We all gave time voluntarily Carpaz gave me some money for expenses to come to Colombia, but otherwise everyone's been working voluntarily. And essentially the idea was to produce something that actually had some rigor to the definition and to actually researching, well, who are these people?
Mm. And what did you come to, how did you define then what is an elite in the Colombian case?
Yes. Well, first of all, I had to define the word generally because, yeah. And I'll try to be brief on this because not everyone might be interested in all this detail, but we have a whole, at least since Karl Marx talked about class, so we're talking about the 1840s till today, we have an extraordinary rich literature on elite. And for much of, I would say until the middle of last century, to the 1960s, this was very much concentrated in Europe. Mm. And it began with Marx, but then you had the Italian school of Pareto and Mosca, who started to question, well, do we need to really accept class? No, because now power is in politics and is in the political elite, not the economic elite. And the argument was, well, ultimately, Marx hasn't shown why exactly the economic elites managed to control the state. So that's led to a sort of foundation of a kind of basic debate between liberal political theorists and Marxists, which has continued in various forms, but more nuanced until our day. But I would say you first of all need to draw attention to the fact that for kind of the early part of last century, the notion was, let's focus on political elites. It's inevitable there will be elites. That elites emerge in all organizations, including trade unions, as well as other organizations. And ultimately, that's the society we live in. And one of the problems that Pareto, the school, felt was the quality of these elites isn't always great. So you have a sort of circulation of elites, but that doesn't mean you have elites as meaning the best, which was sort of one of the ideas of the word. Then you had the sort of post-Second World War in the States. You had right wingers, and you had the sort of people influenced by the left coming back in, saying you can't understand power in the United States unless you understand the relationship between the corporate elites, the military elites, and the political elites. Robert Dahl, is pluralism? No. There's too much power, is not concentrated, it's dispersed. And so we have plurality. And then you have the Marxists coming back with Poulantzas and Miliband, for whom, Marx didn't show exactly how the economic elites, the capitalist class, controlled the state, but they don't have to control it directly, said Poulantzas. You have a relative autonomy. And then Miliband said, no, in the UK, you show that this elites come from the same school and then to the state. And now, just to get to the theorist who probably influenced me most in coming up with how we've understood elites and what has been very important for our empirical work is Pierre Bourdieu. Because Bourdieu, the French sociologist, who was looking at the shifts in the late 60s in France and the way it looked as if a technocratic elite of the haute école was coming to control France rather than the capitalist class. And Bourdieu was influenced by Marx, but not a deterministic Marxist. But he was certainly interested in forms of capital. But this is the interesting thing. First of all, he begins to say it's not just economic capital, though he does believe economic capital matters most. But he looks at cultural capital, which is tastes and knowledges, your spaces you enjoy. And you draw on that cultural capital. You have symbolic capital, which is reputation, which is recognition, prestige. And there's social capital, which is your social relationships and your family. So he begins to look at this notion that you have a range of different capitals being brought in and drawn upon by the most powerful, and they are in dispute as to who's going to kind of, whose capital is going to, this is the key sentence, to dictate the dominant principles of domination. And this becomes a very key part of our work, because what Bourdieu gives us is to dictate the dominant principles of domination means that these various capitals are drawn upon to say in which field of capital, which principles will we all have to agree are the principles of the elite that we all have to acknowledge are the most powerful. And then finally, Mike Savage in my university came up with the notion, also influenced by Bourdieu, of constellations of elites. So there's not one hegemonic elite, but constellations or groups of elites disputing amongst themselves where these dominant principles lie. So it means that we didn't, in our work, believe that you actually had, you just looked at the Bogota elite or one elite that dominates Colombia. You have to look at dominant elites in a range of fields and the capitals they draw upon to actually determine those dominant principles of domination. Anyway, sorry, that was a bit long.
No, but not at all, because now I see it, and I see it in the report, because you do put down the political elite, you have the economic elite, you have the technocratic elite, you know, the judicial elite, the unions as well. I'm sure I'm missing some, but I noted a lot down. And that makes perfect sense. And of course there are, it's not, I mean, well, I think we could say that in Colombia, things are majority Bogota, but as you say, the constellations that we can look, obviously, at Medellin has been a shifting. Cauca moves so much money. But then if I'm thinking of, you know, and I didn't want to jump into this, but I looked into, you said you've got the Ardila group. So they, you know, Bogotano, I guess, I think. I mean, are they Bogotano, Ardila Lule? And yeah, so they're RCN News. And all of that, Postoban, but also in Cauca. So down there with the sugar that comes through and so on. So I see this in the constellations, very interesting. So why then, if we're moving forwards and so on, and I keep looking at my studies and I'm looking at the sort of domination that took place, I have to ask, you know, and around the 1940s, and I know your studies, your this report starts in 1991, new constitution, good place to start on any study about Colombia if you're going to do the actuality. But in the 1940s, when Fernando Mazuera came in as mayor of Bogota, was it four times or so? He was from the provinces, and from what I understand, I mean, what we would say, the provincia, it's kind of a, you know, classist thing, it's the problem of the provinces, but that's how it was seen. And I'm thinking as well, it's a, he then married into the Kling family, and that gave him a certain prestige, which we still see today. So how would someone...
Social
capital then. There we go. There's your other one, social capital, because then you start seeing his photos in society magazines when I think previously he wouldn't have been. He would have just been a political figure. So social capital is very interesting. It's like an influencer, isn't it? That ghastly word. but that's, I mean, that's so interesting. I want then there's something else that you draw on massively, of course, is land reform. And if we just, and I know we're jumping around, but I think, you know, for the benefit of my listeners, that we just jump around like this, land reform has never taken place here, right? I mean, every other Latin American country has had some sort of land reform, be it, as far as I know, I mean, but land reform has never taken place. And of course, point number one on the peace accords from 2016, and Gustavo Petro, president, has talked about the need for land reform. But as you say in your report, this has been a uniting source of discord by these elites, because it's not just politics and economics and so on. The land is connecting. It's like the hilo conductor all the way through. So how do we see this developing? I mean, first of all, how do these people get all the land? They're just, I mean, just sort of appropriate it?
Well, there has been a lot of that. And of course, that is how land has been generally appropriated, even in England, you know, originally. And so I think you can, you know, I should sort of in parentheses say that one of the reasons we are doing this work, I mean, this is only the first stage, by the way, because okay. We've got other stages, is because we're very connecting this issue to violence and peace. Right. So the issue of land reform is very important because it's, as we know, land has been one of the sources of some of the most horrendous violences in Colombia. Mm. And so the notion of land and defense of the right to property we see this as what we call these principles of domination in the history of Colombia that elites have tended to agree to as something that, although there might be constellations, you have elites in different sectors, it's not the same as Sindicato Antioqueño, the sort of those that have come out of the industrial sector of Medellin and Antioquia, as the Cauca elite or the elite of the Valle de Cauca, where you've got the Azucareros, etc. They have very different sort of histories and very different processes. But at some level, there's an agreement that you don't touch property. Mm-hmm. The sacralization de la propiedad, we call it, the sacralization of sacralization of property. And so we, that's not the only issue of dominant principle of domination, but it is clearly one that connects very much this study to the problem of violences, because one has to ask, well, why is it that at the end of the day, the defense of property has led elites to rally round to actually prevent any sort of agrarian reform, which could have been the source of democratization, opening up a different kind of agriculture, opening up possibilities for Colombia when it is one of the most unequal regions in the world, and certainly in terms of land tenure. And so this history is particularly important. And when I compare it, say, to England, for instance, in this sense, in the sense that elites in England, and I don't say this, what I'm about to say is not because I think elites in England have not used violence, because they absolutely have, but there was this moment of shift when the rural sector and the landed sector, right, gave way politically to the industrial sector, the manufacturers, right? And so, I mean, I'm cutting a long story short.
Yeah, very much.
But Barrington Moore, a famous historical sociologist, puts it this way, say, without a bourgeoisie, there's no democracy. So in other words, if you didn't have the emergence of a class that came out of a new constellation, if you like, that becomes dominant, puts forward different dominant principles, if you don't have that, you are then going to have a society that is continuously exploiting an agrarian class, making it extremely difficult to make change in any sense peacefully. And also what's happened over time in UK and Europe, given in terms of agrarian change, we could also look at South Korea and places in the global south, which have become ultimately industrialized. Agrarian reform played a big role in that. And it played an extraordinary role, ultimately, in transforming attitudes of elites, in the sense that they began to invest. And this began happening earlier than the kind of rise of industrial bourgeoisie, but the sort of decision to accept a third party to sort out conflicts between elites. That's what I call the rule of law for the minute. I mean, again, lots more to say about that. But it took centuries, and our elites continue to use violence overseas. But when you look at the history of Europe, the one form of violence that did decline was interpersonal male or male violence. Mm-hmm. This has not happened in Colombia. And so this issue of agrarian reform that you've raised becomes incredibly significant, because defending the right to property has led elites to use violence or to support violence. And that, I think, is one of the key challenges the country faces.
I think this is this point of the industrial class, let's say, the factories in England. We have the factories here, but it's not an industrialization as we would consider it. So this has permitted, let's say, the land owning elites to appropriate what little industrialization occurred, say maybe the transport industries, or maybe the construction industries, or the, as you said before, the azucareros, the sugar. Would we say that they've been able to then sort of push this into their own form of domination rather than creating constellations?
Well, it's a very complex history, of course, but if you look at Antioquia, where industrialization did take place, actually the origins of that industrialization was a much more sort of socially conservative form of the very idea of what the industrialists of Antioquia did. was to kind of create some attempt to create some sort of social form. You have people like Nicanor Restrepo, who I interviewed, who emerged out of that, who would consider himself in some sense a kind of more like our industrial bourgeoisie, if you like. But that industry collapsed, of course, that textile industry, right? And it's not, I think, a coincidence that the drug trafficking emerged just as that collapsed. And then in terms of these other regional elites and their sort of relationship to land and to economic development, I think these different sectors, what has been very important in Colombia is until the 1991 constitution, you could say, there was a kind of two-party bifurcated elite that managed to divide the elite, but divided it through ultimately a sort of Bogota concentration of the political elite, if you like, and a transactional politics that is most evident in the Frente Nacional, the National Front Pact, in which they divide up the state, if you like. And that, I think that politics there, something we want to look at more is how drug trafficking affected that transactional politics, you know, in which the cost of the vote, I remember when I first came to Colombia in the 70s, the cost of the vote was rising. And so, you know, that sort of also ultimately had a great sort of impact on the nature of the political system. But then we have the 1991 constitution. And what we found, and that's why we took that date, was some shifts here of that Bogota political elite no longer controlling politics in quite the same way. The fragmentation of elites and the rise of regional elites. And I think this issue, and for us, for instance, in our study up till now, we've clearly looked at the elites in a national sense. Yeah. But what we haven't done yet is look at all the regional elites to explore each of those processes in every region, because that's what we need to do. That's a very complex history. It is not the same, the Costa Caribeño, you know, what happens there, the Char and other sort of things. It's not the same as what happens in the Cauca Casanare, where I've worked, or other places. And so, you know, this is something that we need to get a grip on more. There's obviously lots of people that have done very useful studies who
It's kind of terrifying, in truth, when we look at it. If you're going to do a regional, or let's say almost family by family per region study, we're looking at volumes. I mean, this is going to be, it will be, end up being, you know, an absolute sort of opus to rival the Encyclopedia Britannica. But because I can just see the leather bound. Now, you did a lot of the investigation into this by interviews. How did you interview people and not tell them, well, we think you're the elites, or did they just accept it?
No, I talked sort of quite openly, really, about the study we're doing, because, again, our aim is not to create enemies or to create hatreds or to, it's to create understanding and debate. Mm-hmm. It's to generate debate. And so we weren't there to interview people and make them feel awful. We were there to actually invite them to sort of help us understand how they think, what are the motivating factors. Particularly, I was interested in how they understand violence, how they respond to violence, when do they respond to violence, how do they. We've started work, and we've already got quite a lot on this, on which elites began to support the peace accord in 2016, and who funded the campaign for supporting it and who was against it. And so there's some issues here about, you know, we needed to know how, you know, what were their motivations. And so so very, very interesting, really. I mean, I could go into a lot of detail and there won't be time, but, you know, I could, you know, I've managed to sort of, I suppose, get a sense of the these great differences in the constellations and how sectoral interests make a difference. You know, difference if you're a coffee farmer or if you're a cattle rancher, you're an industrialist, if you're a sugar plantation owner. And so all these sectoral interests, you know, and then to try and find out, well, where amongst these interests is there something which could be brought to bear on supporting a peace project, not just the accord, but the reforms and transformations needed to build peace. That is the great problem, because quite a lot of elites did support the accord. Not all, we know, but quite a few. But it's not really so clear that they actually bought into all the transformations that were going to be needed, such as agrarian reform, which would be needed in order to really make that peace accord work.
And, wow. So who is the biggest name to support it? You don't have to answer that.
No. I mean, the Syndicato Antioqueño supported it.
Okay. There you go. And who would have thought, from Antioquia, you know? Who would have thought?
Yes. I mean, you know, they are the closest to what we might have called a sort of national industrial class. So in some senses, they are the closest to the idea we might have had of a sort of state builder's rule of law, etc. Of course, Medellin has gone through this, as I was saying, a whole period of dealing with drug trafficking. It's still a major issue. And being an elite in Medellin and all the sort of family connections there, you know, we know the sort of story that's out there that there was a great deal of reluctance to let the drug traffickers into the social capital that you need to be elite. It's not so clear that they weren't willing to use the economic capital. And so there are these issues that become quite important, not just the Sindicato Antioqueño. I think the sort of economic capital from drugs has probably been quite significant and not talked about quite in the way it ought to be, for obvious reasons. But clearly, it's a major issue in so many ways, and in terms also of willingness for some elites to support. To what lengths would you go to support resistance to agrarian reform, but also to insurgents on the left, of course?
I think there's I've got your report here. So how many people did you interview? Do you have that idea of thousands?
Around about 50 to 60.
Okay.
Yes.
Because then, but I was looking at the figures here in your report. There's 1,281 people belonging to the elite, and then you sort of divide it up. That makes 0.02% of the population. Yes. I want to know a little bit, I mean, how does that, because you know obviously the rest of Latin America very well, but how does that compare, for example, to a place like El Salvador or Guatemala, which have been obviously very traditionally ruled by elites?
Yes. I mean, there isn't a data bank similar in those countries, although I've just been in Guatemala, in fact, and they've just translated another sort of study I did on elites and violence in Latin America, because it's a huge interest and huge issue for the countries. But yes, I would say probably wealth is even more concentrated. But one of the differences I particularly noted in Guatemala, and more so just now, is, for instance, in Colombia, we found that the military are not part of the elite, right? Mm-hmm. So there's always been a principle that the rule in Colombia would be by civil power, and the military would be subservient. And we also found that the military came from provinces, not from the sort of elite universities or schools that the elites come from. And so there's a kind of really big sort of differentiation between the military. And that's something that means Colombia stands out from other parts of Latin America. But in Guatemala, what's interesting and what's happened over the last sort of couple of decades is the military, who served the elites for a long time in Guatemala, now want to be the elite, right? And this is a very worrying development. So you have in Guatemala, you know, increasing role of the military in politics and society. They've always had a role, but now it's like they also want the status and the wealth that others have had. So there's that sort of issue there that's emergent in Guatemala that is particularly sort of significant. And then in El Salvador, which is a country I've spent time in and was there a lot in the war, there, I think what you've got is a backlash to elites from a politician who comes from a new elite, right? Bukele. He's, you know, part of, and here I'm introduce a concept we haven't talked about yet, which is oligarchic elites.
Yep.
And I need to introduce that because basically Bourdieu, you know, believed that economic power was gave you a greater capital and resource than any other to define politics and to define the dominant principles. What happens with economic power is that the defense of wealth becomes important, which means you don't necessarily put all your eggs into the basket of one political group. You can actually fund different political groups. But your defense of wealth is very important. So if you look at a family like the Zielinski in Colombia, right, you were looking at something rather like the Bukele in El Salvador. And you're looking at an elite that's emerged in the neoliberal era more than, you know, any other. They're not the old landowning elites. Right. They're the elites that have sort of, you know, emerged in a different way. And those elites actually do look at politics differently. And of course, Bukele has been able, I mean, you know, it's not usual for oligarchic elites to go directly into politics, but Bukele, the son of a big businessman, has done so. But he's come in the name of being anti-elite.
Yeah, which... it's sort of playing it both off, you know, for himself, for the personal benefit. When we the Zielinski, would we say that the Zielinski elite is an urban elite?
Yes, I would say it was an urban. It is an urban elite, and Zielinski is now in the Forbes list of the most. And what we found with Adila Lule and with others is they've, you know, what. It's very interesting. It's dominant principles domination. It's how do you ensure your ideas of what makes a good society? Where are the best kind of politics? You know, how do you do that? And of course, owning media,
yeah,
owning newspapers, owning Semana. And now Zielinski owns Semana. And yeah. So, but he did also give funding to Petrol.
Yeah.
And so you have there the kind of the defense of wealth. Means you hedge your bets rather. But you know, they're still very powerful figures.
Very pragmatic, isn't it? Very but when you I was going to get on to the issue of the media, of course, jumping to it, the media, of course, you've got, you know, the Sarmiento group, well, yes. That's it. Zielinski with Semana, Santo Domingo with Caracol. That's 220 different branches. And Ardila Lule with RCN, however many that is. And they really do control the yes. information. I mean, yes. That's the truth of it. But I was looking at this, and you said, you know, when you brought up the elite oligarchy, there's 46 people.
Yes.
Tiny number, 46, yes. When you yes. think of a population.
We've used the Forbes list and the Semana publication of the richest, you know, every year. Yes, yes.
And so the 44, you know, 46 people, but the 44 families and 1,000 companies, this is all from the report. So if we name them, it's Sarmiento, you know, Aval and El Tiempo, Santo Domingo, D1, D1, Caracol, Echavarria, Falabella, Corona, Zielinski's, Remax, GNB, Surameri, Suramericana, Nutresa, Semana, of course, Ardila, RCN, Posto One, Incauca, Cortez, Grupo Bolivar, Davivienda, Mejia, Correa, Al Costo. And then it sort of splinters out, as you see. But these are the, and we can pick up the Char, or the Araujo, the Morenos, the Masueras. And I just find it amazing that you've done this. When you put this down, and it's been in El Espectador and other people, have these people responded to you, the people that you've put them there? Because despite the fact you say that this is for debate and for conversation, I mean, there's going to come with a negative. It comes with a negative slant, not necessarily from you, but the way we now perceive elites, you know, it's not it's not a gentleman's club. it's certainly a man-dominated club, but it's not like I would yes. say a gentleman's club of old. This is a very powerful, very small, very politically and economically, you know, powerful group. As I yes. said, so did any of them get in touch with you or even threaten you when you brought this out?
No, we've had some sort of political elites get in touch and shown a great deal of interest. And some, not some elites, but people I would say were part of Constellations, but not these, the most powerful. Some of the people who got in touch with this, I think, are actually also quite concerned. Not because of, you know, the potential for negative reactions, but I think because there's a recognition that the inequalities that Colombia faces, is so entrenched.
Yeah.
And these principles of domination that have so made it impossible to introduce the reforms that are going to be necessary to address those inequalities and to give everybody a life chance. And at the end of the day, I think it's hard for them to sort of connect this structure of power with the violence. And for me, that is the critical issue, that it's hard to think of how Colombia is going to reduce the violences. And I talk always about chronic violences in many countries in Latin America work, because the violence is a phenomenon, but it has multiple expressions. Mm-hmm. And so I've watched, one of my years working in Medellin, I've watched the mutations. And I've also watched the fact that the measurement of violence just by homicides is not enough. I remember being in one of the comunas in Medellin and finding out that because Medellin was so concerned that its homicide rate gave it this reputation of being the most violent city in the world, the combos, the gangs, no longer wanted to, were no longer going to kill, and you had to ask permission to murder, right? And so, but they continued extorting and selling virginity of young girls. And so, in other words, you know, when you look at the violences and their reproduction, you know, in various spaces, and I haven't dealt with anything like the multiple expressions and the murder of social leaders that have taken place, the differential violences against the Afro-Colombian community, indigenous communities, all the issues that we sadly know happen. But what can we do about these violences? If you don't have a rule of law that's equitable, accessible for everyone, you don't have a sense of justice, you don't have a sense of social justice, you have entrenched inequalities, you have kids growing up in, because Colombia is still a mostly urban country, 80% urban, you know, and we talk about the violences in the rural areas, but there are multiple violences in the cities. And if you're growing up in those environments with very little sense of a future, a long-term future, with drugs selling or trafficking offering incredible advantages that nothing else can offer, then that reproduction violence is going to happen. So the economy has to start looking after everybody. It has to start offering the generations that are growing up in this something new. Otherwise, we will reproduce the intergenerational cycles of violence in Colombia. And that, I think, is a really terrifying prospect.
And this is what we are living. The intergenerational cycles of violence. I wanted to jump in there because I would say that a child growing up in rural Colombia with no opportunities or access to basic human rights, running water, education, healthcare, so on, that itself is a violence. Mm-hmm. I would say that.
If somebody is, you know, there's obviously the famous Galtung's idea of structural violence. I call that inequality. But when people die through malnutrition, their body is affected, right? So for me, the somatic effects of acts and actions of somatic harm, but effects on the body, is what constitutes violence, in that violence sends meanings. It generates meanings and creates meanings and is laden with meanings. That, for me, is what we're seeing. And the reason why, one of the reasons, focusing on elites, is because we often think of, when we think of, think of the poor. But I work as well with many poor communities in Latin America who experience violences. But it made me think, well, where are the elites? They can create, they don't need security at a public level because they can live in gated communities. They can buy private security and they live a life, you know, where they can protect themselves. Now, that began to break down in some areas, such as in Justamente, in Antioquia, when they began to get fears of kidnapping, and in Monterrey, Mexico, the same. And then they began to act, right? And they began to support a different kind of thing. But, you know, you're not going to get security as a public good that really generates security for everyone, including human security, which I really like the fact that Petra is talking about that. You will not get that unless elites are prepared to pay tax and support a public security provision that is genuinely accessible for everybody. And this is a great problem.
Yeah. And if you occurred to me when we were talking about Guatemala and the military becoming an elite, and I suppose that spans back to kind of the Civil War period, Rios Montt bringing in, of course, he comes the political figure, as Jimmy Morales being put in by the military. Is there a possibility of that happening here when you see people like General or now retired General Zapatero? He's on a soapbox, isn't he? And then we had the, for a short while, the vice president, I can't remember his name, for Santos. I was sure that he was going to run for president at some point, because why would you put them into this picture? So are we seeing a shift towards the military becoming an elite?
I mean, this I think gets to the heart of the dominant principles of domination.
Naranjo, that was it.
Yes. From the police force, you know, mm-hmm. well-known policeman, but I don't know whether Naranjo would ever gone into politics in that way, but who knows. Mm-hmm. But I think what is interesting is that is whether or not that these principles of domination are going to change under Petro. You know, is they, as Petro challenges, will you also get the elites rallying round to see how they can defend principles they've always defended? And it doesn't mean that there aren't principles that have been contested. There are. We also talk about those in the document, such as over taxation, mm-hmm. over the state's role in the regions, et cetera, et cetera. But, I mean, issues like that, would ever the Colombian elites actually kind of imagine seeing a military man? We still have no women in major political roles. In politics, that would be a major shift, but it would bring up the possibility that you would think there could be major shifts in other senses as well. And who knows what that would mean and where that would, you know, where it would take us. I mean, I don't see at the moment that the Colombian elite, which has had sort of, you've got such a power amongst the civilian strata, that I don't know the moment when they would call upon the military. Things would have to get pretty, pretty bad in terms of Petro's program. And, you know, I can't at the moment imagine that, but it's not, Colombia has a different history to other places where we do know that has happened.
Yeah, there tends to be the separation a bit there. Colombia's history tends, and we tend to look back at it as well, which sometimes I think can be dangerous. We just say, well, you know, Colombia's never done this or another. Yeah, well, yes. But...
I mean, to be honest, Chile, when Allende came in, you know, in 73, as well, he was overthrown in 73, no one would have expected the military to come in. But exactly. Then you have the United States backing that. Mm. And so you've then got the issue of the shifts in global power and exactly, you know, what the role of United States will be, because up until now, one of the principles of domination has been precisely to accept the US as the policy reference point.
Yes, this is true. This is true. Now, so much. There's too much. We talk about the people who have most suffered in this violence, the traditional communities, such as the Afro communities and the indigenous communities, and then the deaths of social leaders. But this comes back to land again, doesn't it? And then, so I ask you this, is that the land, if it's being fought over or in the eyes of many, protected because it belongs to others. You know, we see these awful figures because we're in the city, so we just see them on the front pages and so on. We don't live it. But we see these awful figures of massacres or murders and contract killings. We capture the guy who pulls the trigger, but who are the people giving the orders? I think that's my question at the end of that kind of digression.
Yes. Well, I know it's a very important question. And I think we've got quite a lot of data now and information about the fact that paramilitaries were funded by elites, landowning elites, cattle ranchers and others. And so there clearly is a willingness to use violence to protect crops. Already, we are seeing Indigenous people sort of feeling that they've got some sort of possibility now to regain land that they've lost. And we're now seeing responses to that from landowners and economic interests.
Well, I'll say it, Fedegan for César. Yes, I'll say it.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the cattle ranchers, you know, they feel, and I mean, there is a history in Latin America as well of cattle ranching, you know, being behind death squads. I've seen it in Chiapas, in Brazil. So there's a whole issue there about those elites particularly feeling they have the right to defend their land no matter what, and whether, and even though it was seized from Indigenous people in the past, they consider they will defend that no matter what, even though we know economically it's often unproductive. Yeah. That we know that we have climate change, we need a new kind of agriculture, that Colombia imports food in an extraordinary fashion when it has the most amazing potential for growing its own food. So these issues are about a whole economic model. And it's very worrying to think that there might be a group of powerful people paired to fund sicarios, assassins, other armed groups to defend their right to own land.
Yeah. I talked about this a couple of weeks ago with Jessica Lopez in University of Lund, and actually she's an expert in land transformation, and it was fascinating to talk about that. It's like, you know, the cattle farming isn't productive at the end of it. It's just not. The land is, you know, but they keep pushing in the frontiers. But let's, and now when we talk about these constellations and the regions and cattle farming, there's a, I want to bring in my own personal experiences, because everybody who listens to this knows I have businesses in Mompos, Bolivar, and the politics is run by the Montes family, which you've put in the report. I mean, totally. And even one of the, even when they do their campaigning, or let's say the person they have backed to be mayor, the campaign's poster is like Montemos Albus. I mean, they don't make any bones about it. And then, I know that they put people into the Consejo in Bolivar and from Mompos and so on and so forth. And it's an open secret. It's when it's not even a secret at all. It's like, are you Montista or you're not a Montista? Are you this? And it's so very interesting to see that it plays out on this level. And then across the river, I think it was San Zenon, where the urns were burnt and so on. So it had one of the latest sort of local elections. And it's election over, I mean, there must have been 400 people in that town. But the two parties were the Conservative Party and the Central Democratico Party. But it's about who controls the territory. And then on that side, that's Magdalena, that's the Gnecco or Gnecco, I don't know how you say it.
Yes, yes.
And then the other people that we deal, so we have the Montes running Mompos and around. And then just over the way in Sucre, we have the Garcias. And everybody knows, and everybody yes. knows what the Garcias did when he was mayor of Cartagena, and you know, taking half of the port with him, tying up the healthcare system, finishing off social security. Everybody knows, and yet it still just continues. And I just don't understand it, because to see it in your report is wonderful, to see it in writing, but we live it, and I don't in places like Sucre and, you know, Medio Magdalena in the middle of Bolivar or middle of César or the middle of Magdalena, I don't see it changing. But I'll jump in again. You've got the three or four options that academics have written down as how to sort of, it's not destroy elites. It's how to sort of go about decreasing the importance. And I tend to sort of veer towards the James Robinson solution. It's like just taking away I guess it's the importance again, taking it away, just, you know, gradually sort of diminishing. But this is going to take time. Would you be more towards Robinson or Piketty or elsewhere? What, because you've got a few up there, and Piketty, of course, has been advising Petro on economics, yes. which has got a lot of people up, you know, got got their backs up a little bit for his. I mean, perhaps you could talk to us a little bit about those different solutions from the different academics.
Yes. Well, of course, you know, the first solution, destroying, is the historical one of Europe. And it's the revolutionary one. And ultimately, we've seen what attempts to do that through the sort of insurgencies in Colombia, which have ultimately led to more and more violence, horrific violence as well, on both by insurgents, but by the army and by the paramilitary, etc. And so I don't, you know, I can't imagine anybody sees that as a very good way forward. But, you know, the James Robinson one, the kind of, you know, we have to think, well, will the elites allow themselves to be disappeared, if you see what I mean?
No. So careful with that word.
Yes, exactly. Sorry, yes, absolutely, yes. And no, I did not mean disappearance. So my big question is, you know, these are powerful people who have tended to come together when necessary. And even what you were just describing of all the elites in these regions and areas, the transactional politics, right, has meant that, you know, the Bogota elite to run the country has had to depend on those people and allow them to entrench themselves, right, through the deals that are done for votes. And which means that, you know, we've had an increasing fragmentation, an increasing capacity of those elites to entrench themselves. And so, you know, it's hard to see what they would give up peacefully, right? This is my great fear. And so I'm very much a peace, I call myself an antropóloga de la paz, a peace anthropologist. I've written a lot about violence, and I'm, you know, and my latest book was on a politics without violence, ? And so I'm sort of always looking, you know, to the fact we actually found a way to have a address with the violences, we would do more politics and we would have more participation. And I suppose the part I like about Piketty is that I think he is talking, and his latest book, one of his very long detailed books, is on participation. And I'm very into participation. I tend to feel that I feel if we can work to reduce violences, we enable more participation to work on the conditions that reproduce violence. That sounds like a strange sentence. But it feels to me that there's an iterative process where, you know, we need to start saying, you know, encouraging people to recognize, including the elites, that violence cannot be a way for defending their interests. If you're going to have a serious democracy, you cannot have it underpinned by violence. There has to be the rule of law, and there cannot be impunity, and there has to be, I mean, I'm very interested in the work of the HEP, in begun work on restorative justice, and at least to find a way forward. And who knows how far Petro's total peace will be able to be workable. But, you know, he's obviously putting out something there. And he put in his inauguration, I really did welcome his emphasis on all the violences.
Yeah.
If we could make the sort of addressing violence one of the critical issues and encourage the elites who cannot want violence to touch themselves, right? So they can't allow it to touch others. And to have, you know, Latin America has more private police, privately, than it has state police. And I think Colombia is probably the same, although Colombia's done quite a lot of work on police reform, including General Naranjo, who you mentioned earlier. But we still have a long way to go. Police are still not trusted. There's still issues of corruption. So you need a security policy. So anyway, it's a long answer to your question because your question is very, very complex.
Yeah.
You know, I tend to feel to face realities, there is no evidence yet that the elites are going to allow their wealth to be questioned and to allow for the transformation. I would like to see that a sector of the elites will see that that's the only way you will get a democratic country and also a country that could be economically preparing for climate change and socially preparing, you know, and to deal with all those violences that are so horrendous and terrible. And a country with such an educated sort of strata as Colombia, to sense that you also live side by side with some of the worst violences in the world and the highest levels of inequality. There's something I would like to appeal to that. And perhaps James Robinson is thinking of this, that, you know, ultimately there could be some agreement they can do better.
Yeah, I think at the end, and I won't take up more of your time, when you look at that and we say sort of appealing to a kind of humanity, appealing to a kind of decency about it, I would put that in the same sort of umbrella as Santos thinking that the idea of peace would just be enough to push through the, you know, the referendum. Of course it wasn't, because it was picked apart at every level. And I would love that, just, you know, nice nebulous phrases such as, or terms such as decency and humanity might appeal. It's so tough though, isn't it? It's so tough when you think, oh, you know, your wealth might be questioned. And then of course, when you have an opposition who's saying, oh, we're all going to get poorer. Everything's going to get more expensive. Everything's going to do this. But they all tether together. The taxes, the inequality, the land owning, the political participation, they all make one final argument. It's one final discussion, but each strand needs to be addressed before we get anywhere. And I don't know, I find myself, I have moments of great hope, and then I have moments that perhaps not such great hope. I think that's it. And I worry when I hear some people talking about this and that, and you're just like, okay, you know, I may be socially conservative when it talks, when you talk of culture and education and things like that. Yeah. But on the other side, you know, I'm pretty liberal. It's like, surely we should be participating to improve situations and so on.
Yes.
And then I just feel like I'm some sort of hippy dippy, because no, we've got to look after ourselves. And so I don't know. I think there's much more to be discussed here. And so I just take this moment to say thank you so much for your thoughts and sharing the report. And when can we expect the next segment out?
I think it's going to be next year, but don't worry, we're totally committed.
Okay.
Following this up, and this, as you said just now, there is so much more to do and so many more aspects to the debate to be had. And I just want to end on this, because Colombia is an extraordinary creative society.
Yes.
It is amazingly creative. I love it.
Yeah.
You know, and it has incredible social movements and organizations as well that are also building peace, you know, and doing stuff on the ground, which we don't often see. It's not as visible. Mm. That also always, but I connect with those people a lot, and I think there's always hope in that. Mm. But clearly we all have to work together. And this, the idea of this is, let's get this debate out there really seriously.
It really needs to be more of a conversation, and like you said, but with President Petro talking about the violence is a huge step in the right direction.
It's a huge step.
You know, whether you like him or not, we do need to talk about this inequality and the violences in all their forms, like we've discussed in this show.
Yeah.
So hopefully, let me take this moment and just say thank you so much to Jenny Pierce, who is a research professor at Latin America and Caribbean Center at the London School of Economics. Thank you for your time. I know it's late over there in the United Kingdom. All sorts of things going on. I heard something happened recently over there, but let's not discuss that. But thank you so much for your time. It has been a real pleasure. And promise us, when you get the next one out, we'll have you back on the show.
Yes, thank you very much. Great, very nice to talk with you. Thank you so much.
A real pleasure. Goodbye. This episode was brought to you by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean. Since 1967, their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. And also, our other sponsor is BNB Colombia Tours, experts in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. The team at BNB Colombia Tours can provide you with fantastic private experiences, creating wonderful memories of Colombia for a lifetime. Check out the website at bnbcolombia.com, complete the free itinerary form, and tell them that Colombia Calling sent you to receive a further 5% off their already great prices. So that's bnbcolombia.com, and of course, latinnews.com. Thank you for everyone for listening. That's us. Farewell. And of course, check back next week. Bye-bye.